something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our exploration of the invention of air conditioning. Now, in the last episode, we focused on a lot of ancient techniques for versions of passive cooling, and some of these involved like fans, circulation of air around the body, or designing buildings to increase circulation of air. Some involved chilling air by passing it through like underground channels of cold water, a particularly ingenious solution from ancient Persia. But today we're going to be getting into the modern science and chemistry of air conditioning.
Yeah, because as we discussed in the last episode, all these various techniques of the past, they all range from like mild to moderate in their effects. Mm-hmm. And when used together, you know, they could improve the quality of life for the individuals that were living with them. Mm-hmm. But modern air conditioning, as we'll explore, was a huge game changer.
Yeah. Now, this is going to be one of those episodes where we can't name a single person as the undisputed inventor of modern air conditioning. Instead, I think what we see is a lot of different engineers and inventors at different times coming up with new versions and variations of cooling and refrigeration technology. So it's going to be inevitable that we're not going to be able to talk about all of the people who contributed some important early experiment or design that led to modern refrigeration and air conditioning. Instead, we're going to be focusing on a few highlights we found interesting.
Yeah, and likewise, we're going to discuss some things that are more refrigeration-based in the technology. But we're focusing mostly on air conditioning.
Right.
And yet at the same time, the history of these technologies is kind of interwoven with one another.
Yeah, inherently.
Because
they're
both attempting to do a very similar thing, and that is to take a warm substance, be it some water or a certain body of air, mm-hmm. and making them cooler or making them absolutely cold.
And in many cases, modern air conditioners and modern refrigerators work on the same principles. Not in every case, but mm-hmm. in a lot of cases they do. And so the more I thought about this, the more I thought it would make sense to start with a brief, simplified explanation of how modern air conditioning generally works. And then we can, after that, go back in time and work our way up to it with some of these interesting stories about early stabs at it. So as we mentioned in the last episode, there are multiple ways to cool the air in a room or cool the people in a room. But the most common method today uses a system of hollow coils filled with a fluid called a refrigerant, which is usually something chosen because it has a low boiling point, meaning it changes from a liquid to a gas at a low temperature. And the fluid in this coil system flows constantly in a circuit that takes it back and forth between the inside and the outside of your house or whatever building or space you're trying to cool, converting back and forth between a liquid and a gas and carrying heat with it one way as it goes. So the whole way an air conditioner works, the simple version is just using this refrigerant to absorb heat from the air in your house and then dump it outside. And I'm not going to get into super technical chemistry or anything like that. We're just giving you the Cliff's Notes version here. So the Cliff's Notes version is when you've got this fluid, the refrigerant, it's in a cold liquid form, it flows through this coil on the inside of your house known as the evaporator coil. And these coils, there's a blower motor that blows the air over them really fast. And this causes these cold coils to absorb heat from the warm air inside your house and cool that air off in the process. The heat from the air is going into the coils. And then the nice cold air, of course, that results from this blows out your AC vents and is just, it's just now the indoor air that has been nice and dehumidified and cooled off by passing over these coils. The heat from the warm air inside your house heats up this fluid inside the coils and converts it from a liquid into a gas. And the air in your house can do this because the refrigerant, again, it's got a really low boiling point. So it's very easy to convert this liquid into a gas. This is something we see commonly in many early experiments with refrigeration and with air conditioning is they find some kind of chemical like ether or like alcohol that has a low boiling point. So it's easy to cause this evaporation. And as we know from the last episode, evaporation sucks energy out of the surroundings. It's an energy-hungry process, and so it cools off everything around it. But now you've got these coils full of refrigerant that have absorbed the heat energy from the air in your house. And that heat energy has to go somewhere, right? It can't just disappear. It's got to be dumped. So the fluid then flows outside. And somewhere along the way here, often if you've got like a, you know, an outdoor unit, it will go through a compressor, and that compressor will be in the outdoor unit. And the compressor is powered by a mechanical device that forcibly smashes that vapor and increases its pressure by using electrically powered components to reduce the volume. It smashes it down. And then this pressurized refrigerant flows through condenser coils. These are in the unit outside the house or in the part of the air conditioner that's sticking outside, which are another set of coils exposed to the outside air. And this, of course, it has another fan that rapidly blows the outside air over these coils. So the outside air rapidly absorbs the heat from the hot compressed refrigerant inside the coils. So the heat gets just dumped out into the air outside. And this allows the refrigerant to cool off and condense back down into a liquid. And then finally, before the refrigerant can go through the evaporator coils inside again, it passes through a device called an expansion valve, which lowers the pressure that the compressor forced into it. So now you're back to what you started with. You've got this low boiling point liquid that can again be exposed to the air inside your house, blowing that air over it really fast with a fan, and it cools the air down and removes humidity from it in the process.
Yeah, when you lay it all out, it's this elaborate process. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to take air conditioning for granted when it is working, but it does remind me how when I was a kid, we would go to my grandfather's house, and he had window units in the major rooms of the house, and when one was not functioning,
right.
he was a super handy guy, so he would take it out of the window and he would take it apart and repair it and tinker with it. And I remember at the time just marveling at all the things that seemed to be going on inside of that air conditioning.
Yeah,
and he was able to patch it up and get it back in the window and functioning again.
Yeah, it is weird. I tried, like, it's hard. I remember when I was younger not understanding how air conditioning worked and being kind of amazed by it. And I even remember having it explained to me and like just it not clicking. And I got to admit, when we were preparing for this episode, I spent a long time like looking at the diagrams and mm-hmm. trying to hack at it and make sure like, okay, am I sure I'm understanding this right? Because it's not very intuitive.
Right. It's, and the thing is, its household peers are rather intuitive, like a hot water heater.
Yeah.
it's rather simple. You know, you don't have to do much tinkering with it to understand it. I just explained to my son how one works the other day because I neglected, I think, to ever like tell him where the hot water came from.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, oh, well, let's talk about where all the hot water went just now. Likewise, you know, a furnace is a lot more is a lot easier to understand. A washing machine, a dryer, an oven.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the air conditioning requires a few more steps of understanding and really grasp what it's doing.
Well, I think especially because it involves chemistry and phase changes having to do with like phase changes between liquid and gas. And gas and liquid and compression and condensation and all that. So these things I think are less intuitive to us than just putting heat into something.
Right.
But another way you can think about an air conditioner is that it's a heater for outside. An air conditioner is just a heater from outside, and the heat energy that it draws to heat the outside comes from the air in your house. And of course, it accesses that heat energy very rapidly by having this low boiling point liquid and blowing air over it really fast.
All right, so we're going to talk about how we got to this modern technological marvel that is the air conditioning unit. But before we get there, I want to talk just a little bit about we want to basically drop in on a favorite invention and stuff to blow your mind historical figure, and that is, of course, Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, yeah. So he actually did some early air conditioning style experiments.
Yes. Now, to be clear, Ben Franklin did not invent air conditioning. And I, it's interesting. You see this tidbit about Benjamin Franklin, either correctly attributed or sometimes incorrectly attributed, show up on a lot of different air conditioning company websites.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's about just, you know, adding engaging content on the websites, or it's about, you know, ranking and search, and so you just put some fun content on there,
getting some of that founding father mojo.
Yeah, but if you've read anywhere that Ben Franklin invented air conditioning, he did not. I want to be clear on that. But he did experiment with the refrigerating effects of various liquids and the role evaporation plays in the process. He experimented with Cambridge professor John Hadley using ether and a bellows to cool a mercury thermometer down to 25 below freezing.
And this makes sense because while this is not exactly an air conditioning unit, it is basically taking from the same principles that will be employed in the kind of air conditioning unit we just described. Having something with a low boiling point, like while water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius, the boiling point of ether, I think diethyl ether, is around 94 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees Celsius. So it boils much more easily. Blowing air rapidly over a mass of ether is kind of like the blower in a modern AC unit blowing air over an evaporator coil full of refrigerant. It rapidly evaporates and it steals energy from the surrounding air, thus cooling the air.
So Franklin wrote about all of this and about sort of the general knowledge of cooling technology that he was aware of in a 1758 letter to John Lenning. And this letter is available online, I want to read a portion of it here, referring to the experiment that we just mentioned. Quote, "From this experiment, one may see the possibility of freezing a man to death on a warm summer's day if he were to stand in a passage through which the wind blew briskly and to be wet frequently with ether, a spirit that is more inflammable than brandy or common spirits of wine."
Okay. Franklin maybe knew something about brandy and wine. No, I don't mean to.
I imagine he did. I believe he did.
But yeah, so he's talking about the evaporation principle then again, especially if you have something with a very low boiling point. You like put alcohol or ether or something all over a person because it evaporates very readily, and then you blow a fan on them. It will chill them even more than blowing a fan on like a person wet with water.
Right. Now, this first part of the letter about freezing a man to death on a warm summer's day, you see that thrown around a lot, and it does show up on a number of air conditioning websites out there. But the rest of the letter is really cool too. So I want to read the next passage of it that's a bit longer,
okay,
where he just talks about refrigeration technology in general. Quote, "It is but within these few years that the European philosophers seem to have known this power in nature of cooling bodies by evaporation. But in the East, they have long been acquainted with it. A friend tells me there is a passage in Bernier's Travels through Indostan, written near 100 years ago, that mentions it as a practice in traveling over dry deserts in that hot climate to carry water in flasks wrapped in wet woolen cloths and hung on the shady side of the camel or carriage, but in the free air, whereby, as the cloths gradually grow drier, the water contained in the flask is made cooler. They have likewise a kind of earthen pots, unglazed, which let the water gradually and slowly ooze through their pores so as to keep the outside a little wet, notwithstanding the continual evaporation, which gives great coldness to the vessel and the water contained in it. Even our common sailors seem to have had some notion of this property, for I remember that being at sea when I was a youth, I observed one of the sailors, during a calm in the night, often wetting his finger in his mouth, and then holding it up in the air to discover, as he said, if the air had any motion, and from which side it came, and this he expected to do by finding one side of his finger grow suddenly cold, and from that side he should look for the next wind, which I then laughed at as a fancy.
What, so people didn't, like, Ben Franklin at the time would not have accepted that the cold side of a wet finger is where the wind is coming from? That's funny.
Well, in his youth, I assume, yeah. So this letter and various other documents can be found at founders.archives.gov. There's a number of writings from figures like Ben Franklin there. And Ben Franklin's writings are typically worth checking out.
A lot of his letters are just fantastic. There was one we quoted at length in a couple of Stuff to Blow Your Mind episodes we did about the early days of electricity experiments, where Benjamin Franklin describes his attempts to kill and roast a turkey for a big party using Leyden jars.
Franklin is an interesting figure. It would be kind of potentially interesting to come back and look at him in greater detail in a future episode of one of these shows, because he did have his hand in a lot of science. You know, he was a true Enlightenment character. Mm-hmm. You tend not to see individuals involved in American politics so involved in the sciences these days.
Right. Now, before we get on to the more recent notable attempts to actually create some kind of air conditioner for rooms, I guess we could briefly mention one other important figure around the same time in early refrigeration and cooling research, and that would be the Scottish physician and inventor William Cullen, who lived 1710 to 1790, who invented a process for evaporative cooling in the 1750s, which he described in an essay from the mid-1700s with a hilariously bad title, quote, "Of the cold produced by evaporating fluids and of some other means of producing cold."
Well, it's not that bad.
Basically, he got ethyl ether to boil by creating a partial vacuum. So you put ethyl ether, which has a low boiling point, in a chamber, and then you lower the pressure in the chamber, which causes the liquid to boil at an even lower temperature. And the evaporation that causes, of course, again, sucks energy from the surroundings and has a rapid cooling effect on whatever's around this chamber. But we're going to find maybe our first real attempt at creating an air conditioner for a room, not in Scotland, not in Ben Franklin's labs or in his experiments at Cambridge or wherever. We're going to go somewhere else.
That's right. And you'll find out right after this break.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
All right, we're back. So I'm not saying it doesn't get hot in Scotland. But I know a place where it definitely gets hot here in the United States, and that is, of course, the panhandle of Florida.
Did you ever live in Florida?
No, but it's much of my life has been lived in the American South, so Florida has always been a place to go for vacations and such. So generally in summer months when it is sweltering.
Right. So we're going to be turning to a figure, a Florida man named John B. Gorey.
Yes. So John B. Gorey lived 1803 through 1855, was an American physician, born in the West Indies, raised in South Carolina, educated in New York, and then he moved to Apalachicola, Florida in 1833.
And Apalachicola is a small coastal town in the panhandle of Florida. It's near St. George's Island, I think, at some point in my life, I think I actually went on a vacation too.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Apalachicola, and I did not realize its significance in history. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time, or I might have seen a statue of the man we're talking about now.
But of course, you might imagine Florida in the 1800s, there's going to be a good amount of disease going around. This is going to be basically a tropical disease environment.
Yeah, so while he was in Apalachicola, he practiced medicine, but he also studied these tropical diseases, especially yellow fever.
Yeah.
And as miasma theory was still in fashion at the time, he considered bad air to be the key factor in these illnesses. Now, we've discussed miasma theory before. I know we discussed it on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I can't remember if it came up on Invention or not.
I'm not sure, but basically miasma theory was the idea that diseases – it was a pre-germ theory hypothesis on the origins of disease that postulated that diseases were spread by bad air or bad vapors, often associated with bad smelling things like carrion or like swamps or marshes.
Right.
But then there were also more supernatural versions of it that believed that like bad vapors would come down off of the planets or something.
Yeah. I remember discussing those. The planets in graveyards, for instance, certainly, not places you're going to catch a supernatural illness like this. But of course, you can see where the correlation comes in when you're dealing with unburied corpses or swamplands that are loaded with, say, mosquitoes that are, of course, carrying potential human diseases.
Exactly right. Yeah, I think the swamplands thing being a really important point of comparison. There were these ideas of like night vapors coming off of the marsh or the swamp, mm-hmm. where the real problem is that you've got a mosquito giving you malaria or giving you yellow fever. But I also want to say that I think it wasn't just a belief in miasma theory that led to a desire to cool the air in hospital rooms for patients suffering from diseases like yellow fever and malaria. I think part of it was also just the idea of the comfort of the patients. But something this did make me think about was that it's interesting that it seems like we have a – I was going to say natural association. I don't know if it's a natural instinctual association or if it's learned, but this association between cold fluids and cleanliness mm-hmm. and warm fluids with uncleanliness. Like, I don't think that's just me. I think that's a common cultural association. Like, cold air and cold water automatically feel clean, while stagnant warm air and tepid water feel dirty. And I don't – do you think that's like something, you know, from deep in our brains and our primate ancestors, or is that just something we learn in life through culture?
I mean, I don't know. I've never really thought about it much. I mean, obviously, if you're in a hot room, you're likely to be sweaty. And if you're sweaty, over time, that can produce a certain odor. You can feel – you know, dirtier because of it, I guess. And we and certainly in the air conditioning age, you come to associate the outdoors as the place where you sweat, and yeah. sweat being the product of toiling. And then inside, you're going to have access to air conditioning, and this is going to be a place, generally, you know, of more relaxation and maybe cleaner activities. You're not, you know, getting as dirty. But at any rate, Gorey definitely was responding to the idea that a hospital should be cool.
Yes,
in part because of the of the miasma theory that you need some good air in there, mm-hmm. which means you need some cold air.
Right,
cool it down, especially for those feverish patients.
Yes, and you know there's still some truth to this today. I mean, you go into a hospital now not because of miasma theory, but hospitals now tend to be pretty chilly places. Mm-hmm. I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, that's really come to be the case of most like large, you know, buildings of, like schools, libraries. Like, mm-hmm. These are places that are refuges of the cool in hot climates usually. So Gorey wanted to cool down the hospital.
Okay.
And his first approach to this simply involved hanging tubs of ice from the ceiling, which is actually a pretty solid idea given that cool air is going to descend. Right?
Yeah.
But of course, this brings us back to the historic Roman problem and also, I suppose, the Aztec problem as well of how to transport that ice. You know, if you're getting that ice from somewhere, you've got to transport it all the way to your hospital and then hang it up in the ceiling.
Yeah. And so at this time, we talked in the last episode about, of course, yeah, this Roman problem of like bringing snow down from the mountaintops. Snow or ice in ancient Rome, there were people who sold it, but it seems like it was something of a luxury, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to take a lot of work to bring snow down and some of it's going to melt on the way. So it's an expensive proposition. The large scale transport of ice had actually only recently become a big business in Gorey's time here. So in the 1830s or 40s. Due in large part to the efforts of a single ambitious businessman from Boston named Frederick the Ice King Tudor.
Ah, like an Adventure Time. Okay.
Yes. Oh, wait. I didn't know. Is there?
There's an Ice King on Adventure Time. He's, you know, he's a king, an evil king with ice-based powers, but he is the Ice King.
Okay. Well, maybe you be – I haven't seen this, so you'll be the judge of how well this fits with Frederick the Ice King Tudor. So Tudor's shipments of block ice traveled not only to customers in the American South, of course they went to New Orleans and to Charleston and all over the place, but also all over the Caribbean from Havana to Martinique. They even went around the world to Brazil and to Europe and to India. In India, apparently his ice was hugely popular. And the story of Frederick Tudor's ice business, I think, is in itself pretty fascinating. Basically, Tudor developed a process for mass harvesting of ice from frozen lakes and ponds and I think rivers too, in the winter in New England, and then taking that ice harvested from these bodies of fresh water to warmer destinations down south where the ice was sold for various refreshing purposes, often for cooling drinks, but at least occasionally for cooling rooms a la Gorey. And this would have been, to most people, a very new thing at the time. Like, can you imagine how magical it must have seemed living your whole life in a tropical climate and then one day for the first time ever being served a cold drink with ice floating in it?
Yeah. I mean, it must have been magical. This reminds me of the film The Mosquito Coast. Uh-huh. Did you ever see this with Harrison Ford?
Mm-hmm. No, I haven't seen it, but I know about it.
Yeah, well, the central plot involves this character played by Harrison Ford, who's like a brilliant inventor and kind of eccentric and very opinionated and strong-willed individual. And they travel to, I can't remember if it's Belize or Costa Rica or if it was filmed in one of the two. It travels down there with the idea of constructing this ice-generating machine and bringing ice to the people. Mm-hmm. And so there's this wonderful scene where they've created the ice in the machine, and they've transported it wrapped in leaves to preserve it, to show it to some native peoples. And by the time they get there, they're unwrapping the leaves, trying to find this tiny bit of remaining ice. Mm-hmm. And like it's just virtually all melted away at the core.
Well, it also makes me think about the opening of the novel 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. In the first chapter of that, there's this, you know, the mythical history of mm-hmm. this family, and there's a story about the patriarch taking his children to see a traveler brings a chest that has ice in it. None of them had ever seen ice before.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It would have been a magical occurrence. Again, one of the marvelous privileges of the modern age that most of us take for granted.
And how, I mean, I don't want to, like, it seems absurd now that you would harvest ice from a cold climate, put it in a ship, and mm-hmm. ship it to another part of the world. But this turned into a huge business. The Ice King, I should say, had a lot of early failures in like the first decade of the 1800s. For example, some of his early shipments just melted at their port of arrival before they could be sold and used because there were no ice houses to keep the ice insulated after it showed up. Mm-hmm. But over the years, Tudor improved the feasibility and the efficiency of his business in quite a few different ways. A few interesting examples I was reading about. One was, of course, establishing ice houses, right, to store the ice when it arrived in the warmer climates. Another was this quest to find better insulating packing material to keep the ice cold while it was being shipped. Originally, he used straw, but experimented with stuff like rice and even coal dust. Huh. But later, he found that pine sawdust worked best of all to keep the ice cold.
Interesting.
And then later, he partnered with an inventor named Nathaniel Jarvis Wyeth, who, yep, related to the painter Andrew Wyeth.
Huh.
And Nat Wyeth came up with lots of improved methods and tools for Tudor's business, including designs for insulated double-walled above-ground ice houses and, crucially, for a horse-drawn ice cutter that works kind of like a furrow plow. It would saw out ice blocks in a grid pattern as it was dragged behind the horse. And then these ice blocks that were sawed out could be easily broken apart from one another and floated down to a retrieval site. And this apparently greatly streamlined the harvesting process and decrease the cost of ice. And I've got a picture here, Robert, you can see of what this horse-drawn ice cutter looks like. But it's kind of – it's surreal watching these people standing on the surface of a frozen lake that's just cut into a grid. It looks like graph paper.
Wow. Yeah, they're just divvying it up to ship it out.
And in fact, I found this historical connection too good to miss. The American writer Henry David Thoreau encountered commercial ice harvesters at work in Walden Pond.
Oh.
And he wrote about them in his book Walden. Do you mind if I read part of this quote here, Robert?
Oh, please do.
Okay. So Thoreau writes, "Thus for 16 days I saw from my window 100 men at work like busy husbandmen with teams and horses and apparently all the implements of farming, such a picture as we see on the first page of the almanac. And as often as I looked out, I was reminded of the fable of the lark and the reapers or the parable of the sower and the like. And now they're all gone, and in 30 days more probably I shall look from the same window on the pure sea-green Walden water there, reflecting the clouds and the trees and sending up its evaporations in solitude, and no traces will appear that a man has ever stood there. Perhaps I shall hear a solitary loon laugh as he dives and plumes himself, or shall see a lonely fisher in his boat like a floating leaf, beholding his form reflected in the waves, where lately 100 men securely labored. Thus it appears that the sweltering inhabitants of Charleston and New Orleans, of Madras and Bombay and Calcutta, drink at my well." Oh, and he also goes on to contemplate his fascination with the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, and eventually concludes by saying that that the pure Walden water is mingled with the sacred water of the Ganges. Huh. And I guess in mind there, he just has the fact that the ice from his pond is maybe going to end up in India in somebody's drink.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of the reverse of the argument I've heard before that all water has been dinosaur pee. You know?
It's true. All water has been Henry David Thoreau's bathwater. every chunk of ice in every drink you've ever had, Henry David Thoreau washed his butt with. It's probably true. Statistically, it's true.
Yeah. Well, you know, this brings this – boy, the whole question of water purification, the process of water purification is interesting because, we could easily do a whole – well, we could easily do a whole episode on just technology involved in purifying water, but also the psychology of water purification.
Uh-huh.
Like how many steps need to be there, organic or industrial, before we will accept – that we are drinking something that was once potentially urine or bath water that was essentially gray or worse water at some point is now our drinking water. It's quite fascinating when you start breaking down the psychology.
Yeah, well, I mean H2O molecules are H2O molecules. It's like just because H2O was once part of poop or was once part of blood or was once, you know, something else, now it's not anymore.
Yeah, like why don't we – that's gross, but we're okay with having been stardust, you know? That's
– Right.
I mean we kind of pick and choose, don't we?
I mean it doesn't bring the poop with it unless it does.
But we still want to think that, right? We still we still want to think that it is still in some way poop, in the same way that we might listen to the song Woodstock and think, yeah, there is a piece of a star inside me, and it's burning bright with the, you know, with the power of a, of an entire solar system.
That's a good connection, Robert. That's also – it's a bit of that Thoreau energy in there. I know some people actually today think Thoreau is kind of boring, but I found that passage rather beautiful.
Yeah, I did as well.
By the middle of the 19th century, shipped ice was this huge business. And as you might imagine, it could also be fickle, right? Because it's ice. It's not the most stable of commodities. Like, slight variations in the weather patterns elsewhere in the world could potentially mess with supply and demand for ice in a major way, leading to the dreaded ice shortage. So now you're living somewhere hot and you've got a taste for ice, but maybe sometimes the ice market could get mighty tight.
Right. And it's one thing if you're looking for ways to cool your drink down. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at, like Gorey was, at a hospital – a situation where you believe that there's a strong advantage in having a cooled down hospital room, then you're going to want to have some way to produce ice locally. So he became increasingly obsessed with the problem of artificial ice production, and so much so that in 1845 he gave up medicine to look into this full time. And he actually acquired patents in he had acquired patents in the 1830s for an ice machine that employed cooling caused by rapid gas expansion.
Mm-hmm.
It used pumps to compress air by injecting it with water. Compressed air was then submerged in coils within a bath of cooling water. The interjected water condensed out in a holding tank. Then the compressed air was released into a tank of lower pressure brine, bringing the brine tank down to 26 degrees or less. Metal containers of water were lowered in, becoming bricks of ice, which could then be withdrawn.
Okay,
and then he could hang them or position them in the hospital rooms, or they could be used as such to then cool them down.
Right, so he's using compression and expansion of these substances. The rapid expansion cools everything around it. He's using that to cool water and create ice. Now, one question is, why is this often considered a predecessor or an early step in the creation of air conditioning when it is really refrigeration? It's a refrigeration process. I mean, air conditioning is a refrigeration process, but he was creating ice. I think it's probably because Gorey planned to use the blocks of ice to cool hospital rooms.
Right, yeah. That was his initial entry into the world of refrigeration. Today he's recognized a lot more, especially in Apalachicola. You can find a statue of him there. But at the time, he had problems with his invention, and Jacob Perkins beat him out for the title of Father of the Refrigerator in 1835. And Gorey's continued efforts to get his own invention off the ground failed for a few different reasons, and he died without achieving his goal of becoming the master of refrigeration in 1855.
Yeah, for some reason, Gorey faced a lot of harsh opposition and ridicule, especially in the press. I was reading a paper by the American historian Raymond Arsenault about the impact of air conditioning on the culture of the American South. And Arsenault just notes that most of Gorey's contemporaries were dismissive of his achievements. And as an example, one journalist, I think writing for the New York Globe, at some point described Gorey by saying, quote, "A crank down in Florida thinks he can make ice as good as Almighty God."
Well, you know, that is ridiculous, and clearly, you know, shows some anti-Floridian bias. However, you know, that kind of headline wouldn't be completely out of line today. I mean, you still see a lot of headlines about Florida and kind of like, you know, the stigmatization of Florida. Mm. And so you can imagine stories today about a crazed doctor who's quit his medical practice to try and make the perfect ice.
Right, to play God by creating ice.
Right. And, you know, the same people might – if the story were taking place in, say, Brooklyn, it might be something different. Like, oh, this doctor, he gave up his 9-to-5 so he could pursue making the perfect cube of ice for your for your cocktails or your scotch.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, it is always sad on this show when we have to look at an inventor and see that they died penniless or they died without finding the recognition that they sought in life, only achieving it after death. I'm always going to end up as much as possible like siding with those individuals.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, so it's possibly because of this merciless ridicule that Gorey failed to attain or retain investors for his invention. I think he had one major investor, but then that investor died, and then he had trouble getting other investors. And so what did Gorey himself attribute the failure of his invention to? Well, to some extent, he blamed – guess who? The Ice King.
Well, he's up against Big Ice, right?
Exactly. He suspected that Frederick the Ice King Tudor had arranged or financed a campaign of smears and disparagement against him in order to protect Tudor's own ice shipping business from competition. Now, was Gorey correct in his suspicions? I don't know. But if so, it certainly wouldn't be the first or the only time that somebody used dirty tricks to protect an obsolete business model from legitimate competition.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't have to put on a tinfoil hat to imagine a major industry or corporation doing this. They are still doing this sort of thing.
Now, toward the end of his life, Gorey seemed resigned. Apparently, he wrote that he thought America was simply not ready for refrigeration. But maybe America was ready for refrigeration because beginning around the 1850s, there did begin to be some commercial applications for refrigeration developed by some other inventors and engineers, including in food and the food and beverage industries, particularly, I believe, in meat packing and meat shipping.
Yeah, it comes down to the necessity, right? Like where are the areas where there is a definite necessity for refrigeration technology?
Right.
All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will meet the father of air conditioning.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market
as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
All right, we're back. So here we come to a figure sometimes called the father of air conditioning. I don't know if that title is actually deserved, but it's what a lot of people have said. So I don't think there's a way to argue that the guy we're about to talk about was really the first person to create a cooling and humidity control system. But because of his important role in the history of this technology, credit for the invention of the first modern air conditioning system is often given to an American engineer named Willis Haviland Carrier, who designed an air conditioning system while working for a company called Buffalo Forge in 1902. Now, Willis Carrier was born on November 26, 1876 in Angola, New York, and he grew up on a farm. And one story that I found interesting was that apparently as a child, Carrier had difficulties with math in school, even though he would go on to become a successful engineer. And we do have to consider the source here, but there was a biography of Willis Carrier written in the late 1940s by E. Cloud Wampler, who was the chairman of the Carrier Corporation. Wampler died in 1973. But to the extent that we can believe this story, it is, as Wampler tells it, that when Carrier was 9 years old, he had an experience that he believed to be the turning point in his life. And it was that in school, he was learning about fractions and he was just completely stumped, like could not understand what was going on with fractions. How can you have part of a number? It doesn't make sense. So his mother came up with a plan to help him. She sent him down into the cellar to get some apples and to quote from Wampler, quote, "Then he was instructed to cut these into halves, quarters, and eighths, and to add and subtract the portions. So fractions took on a meaning for him. In addition, he made a discovery that most problems which appear difficult can be worked down into something quite understandable."
Well, I mean, that's quite reasonable. You see more and more of that, I'm finding, with mathematical education today. Mm-hmm. I went to some information sessions about how they're teaching mathematics at my son's school.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more dependency on using, not apples, but like physical representations of various values.
Right.
And creating this physical idea of the numbers you're talking about so that you have a grasp of what the numbers are and not just like a paper sense of the numbers.
Yeah. We often on the show express skepticism about like foundational stories about the people who created companies mm-hmm. and stuff like that, because you always wonder like, is this really a true story or is this being told for marketing purposes?
Right.
But if we just accept, okay, let's say we think this is a true story, I can certainly see things like this. I don't know. I see stuff like this happening in real life. Like you're talking about that, like maybe math just doesn't make sense to a kid until they have a kind of like key visual metaphor moment. And there are, I do think, these kinds of breakthroughs. And it makes you wonder about like, I mean, how many kids are there out there who actually could have, you know, have the potential to have really great math-based careers and a lot of success in mathematics, but they just never had the right teaching approach or never like had that moment where suddenly it all clicked?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the believability scale of corporate biographies, I'd give this one was like an 8 or a 9. You know, it's not like he was visited by the angel of refrigeration with a coiled halo or anything.
We're also going to get a Eureka Brain story. That's coming in a second. So he studied engineering at Cornell University, graduating in 1901. So here's the Eureka Brain story as told by the Carrier Corporation. They say that genius can strike anywhere. For Willis Carrier, it was a foggy Pittsburgh train platform in 1902. Carrier stared through the mist and realized that he could dry air by passing it through water to create fog. Doing so would make it possible to manufacture air with specific amounts of moisture in it. Within a year, he completed his invention to control humidity, the fundamental building block for modern air conditioning. Now, whether or not this Eureka Brain scene actually happened, that he was actually standing at the train station when he had his breakthrough vision, it does point to the importance of humidity in the creation of Carrier's first air conditioning system. Carrier's air conditioner was not primarily for the purpose of lowering the temperature of a room for human comfort, but for the industrial purpose of removing excess humidity from the air, which could prevent and the idea was they wanted to prevent humidity from affecting the properties of ink and paper in a print shop environment.
Yeah, Carrier was working at Sackett Wilhelm's Lithographing and Publishing Company in Brooklyn at the time. And this is certainly a reality that I can relate to. The idea of like humidity destroying books and messing with your ink. Because there was, it was like a, not last summer, maybe it was the summer before, playing Dungeons and Dragons on a back porch in like late summer. And it was, you know, we were expecting things to cool down, but things had not really cooled down. It was hot, sweltering. It was so sweltering that we had a marker board to like line out the dungeon, and the erasable markers, the ink from them was just like beating up and was just turning into a wet mess. And the player's handbook that I was using at the time, like it just completely fell apart. Uh-huh. Like the binding, everything got moist from the humidity, and it just became just a stack of wet papers.
Oh, that's horrible.
I mean, it wasn't enough to drive us inside with the air conditioning, but
you know, there's one thing I don't understand. I've got a really good friend who works in she works for the Park Service, and she works in the desert, you know, way out in at Big Bend National Park. And she came to stay at our house recently, and she was talking about how much she loved the humidity sitting in our backyard. And I just thought that was the most amazing. What Georgian is like, I just love it when it's swampy out like
this. I know. We travel out west, and we admire the dry heat.
Right.
Yeah, and I kind of forget that one could potentially, pine after the moist, thick, humid, swimmable heat of the Georgian summer.
And there's a reason related to the air conditioning technology that we've been talking about. There's a reason that so many people prefer the dry heat, which is that in the dry heat, the lower humidity content of the air aids in the evaporation of sweat from your skin, right? The lower the moisture in the air, the faster your skin evaporates, which helps keep your body cool. That's why when the humidity is high, heat tends to feel worse. It's like you can't sweat to get the heat out of you. Or you can sweat. I mean, you will sweat, but the sweating is not as efficient in rising up as gas off of your skin. But anyway, so I guess we should briefly just mention how Carrier's system worked. His method of air conditioning involved blowing air over what were originally heating coils, which, you know, steam would go through to help heat a room. They were originally hollow heating coils, but instead they were filled with chilled water from a deep artisanal well instead of steam. And this cold water caused condensation of of moisture from the surrounding air as that air was blown over the coils, removing the humidity and drying the air in the process. And the plain chilled water system was later upgraded, I think the following year, to include an ammonia compressor, which that's especially good because that'll work during the summer, because now you're taking advantage of the lower boiling point refrigerant, which can be expanded and compressed. And while the original air conditioner was just for this industrial purpose of controlling humidity, Carrier did see the potential. If it didn't just remove humidity but also cooled the indoor air, there could be major non-industrial markets for this system, adding comfort to human-occupied buildings.
Yes, absolutely. And so really out of this, the age of refrigeration, the age of air conditioning is born. And it makes its way into industrial buildings, into hospitals first, but then it begins to find its way into other spaces and eventually homes as well. And this is the point where we would generally, you know, briefly discuss the legacy of a particular invention, but we are going to have to call it and come back and do an entire episode on the legacy of air conditioning because I mean, there are some obvious areas where it's impactful, but it really changed the landscape of certainly American life and in ways that you might not even instantly think of. And so, we're going to come back in a third air conditioning episode to just talk about how air conditioning changed the world.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that one.
In the meantime, you can check out other episodes of Invention at InventionPod.com. You can check out our other show, Stuff to Blow Your Mind, at StuffToBlowYourMind.com. You can find both podcasts wherever you get your podcasts these days. And if you wherever that happens to be, we would just ask that you subscribe to our shows, that you rate and review us if you have the power to do so. Leave a nice remark and recommend us to your friends. Share some of the wisdom that we have unearthed for you with the people that you know. And certainly, if you have anything that you would like to add about air conditioning, the history of air conditioning, your like personal or family history with air conditioning, we would love to hear from you.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Maya Cole and Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.